this is the conductance versus energy, and the conductivity here is going down as you increase the time, and you're digging that dip, and here is the conductance versus log of time at different energies, and you see exactly the same behavior where the one at zero is going down logarithmically in time. Okay. All right, so basically to conclude this part, all I'm saying is that what we've shown is that the Coulomb glass has very slow electrons, long relaxation times. It takes a long time to rearrange when you perturb the system. When they apply the gate voltage and change it, they put in a bunch of electrons. It takes a while for things to settle down. And as a result, the conductivity or conductance goes as log time. And what you're seeing is basically this logarithmic growth is simply the growth in the dip of the Coulomb gap developing at the new Fermi energy. Okay, so there are questions on that. I didn't show you this, but there's also been subsequent work, which I assume Zvi will talk about, on aging in the systems, as well as the idea which we've done work on, and I can give you a paper where if you also will get 1 over F noise. If you Fourier transform log T, you get 1 over frequency, basically, and you can show that you get out of such systems also 1 over F noise. Yeah. It's indium oxide. That's indium oxide done by Zvi of Yahoo's group. Alan Goldman has done, I think, amorphous bismuth, granular lead, and he's done several metals, but he sees basically the same sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a quantity near the equivalent of the local Coulomb distribution? When you talked at the beginning that one considers a spindular system and can compute the local Coulomb distribution,
right,
to see whether the ground state or the supposed ground state is really the ground state.
Yeah.
And you were talking about the behavior of the probability distribution at very small values of the local field.
Right.
So my question is there the equivalent quantity here? And what is this? I mean, you can ascertain whether the excitations, the gap probability distribution of these lowest excitations, has zero weighted zero gap.
Or? Right. That's the Coulomb gap. Is the analogous thing, the Coulomb gap. You can make an analogy because you can say an occupied side is spin up, an unoccupied side is spin down,
yeah,
and they have 1/r interaction, so that's JIJ. And you can draw the analogous sort of thing. There's also, I really didn't show you the actual calculation of the Coulomb gap is really not what I showed you, but there is the Mott's original argument for the Coulomb gap, which is this. And you can actually
find it has a finite weighted zero gap, the distribution, or
it goes to zero, and in three dimensions this is the gap is quadratic in energy, and in two dimensions it's linear. It's a dimensional thing.
So this has consequences for the behavior of the specific heat at low temperature, right?
Well, I mean, the specific heat looks like that of a spin glass. It's a broad bump, at least when we've done Monte Carlo simulations. It's just a broad smear, and the peak is actually...
Yeah, but at very low temperature, when you go to T towards zero,
Right, it goes either linear or 3/2, and I can't remember. Do you remember, Svi, which way it goes? For insulating glasses, it's linear, and metallic glasses, it's also linear, but I'm not sure exactly for these systems, because I remember some simulations on spin glasses where again it goes as 3/2. So I guess that's the answer to Premi's question, that you would see the specific heat going to zero as temperature goes to zero.
Have people measured the gap in these types of low-voltage insulators with tunneling measurements? I realize this is
a... Yeah, they have. Yes, they have.
The same samples or
not? Not the same
similar samples.
Similar samples. Yeah. And they see...
They see it is anomaly.
You see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you do see it in
that. Can you quantitatively do, I don't know, what, kind of well, that first salt area, or, I mean, is it making a particular form, not there?
Well, some people claim that it fits well, some people doubt it.
Yeah, so, I mean, they have seen it, and but I can't remember too much of the details, but, you know, we can find references if you're interested in. All right, this is talk two. This is the second glass, and in this case, I'm going to talk about the glass transition and a glass-forming liquid. So think window glass, and you melt it. And this is a case where the disorder is not quenched, and there are no electrons anywhere to be seen. And I think what I'm going to do, as I was debating whether to give you any introduction at all, I will give you a brief introduction. So the idea, of course, is that you take a liquid, you cool it down, maybe it crystallizes, maybe it doesn't. If it doesn't, you keep cooling, you get a super cool liquid. And as you cool more and more, of course, molecules move slower and slower and get more and more sluggish, and the viscosity grows. Eventually, the time it takes for the molecules to rearrange versus the time you're willing to wait diverge, and at that point you say the system has fallen out of equilibrium because you can't wait long enough to see it move, and we call it a glass, and that occurs at a temperature defined as TG. They exceed experimental times, and who knows if they diverge because you can't wait long enough. But they seem to explode exponentially, or in power law, or however you want to fit it. So there are a bunch of experiments which have seen this. There's a, let me, rather than go through the little list, actually show pictures, because those are sometimes better than words. Here is, for example, the entropy. This is specific volume, which is the volume, say, of a gram of the stuff versus temperature. This is, say, the entropy versus temperature. Lots look the same, so I'll do this one. This is, you cool the liquid down. It crystallizes. You have a crystal, and they have a latent heat. If it doesn't crystallize, you can keep going. You've entered the super cool liquid regime. And then at some point, the glass just peels off from this curve. Depending on your cooling rate, you'll get this curve or this curve. And the idea, which was pointed out by Kautzmann in the 1920s, is that if you actually extrapolated this all the way down, you would actually find the entropy of the liquid going below that of the crystal, or at least meeting with it at the Kautzmann temperature TK, which Daniel Kivelson called this the Kautzmann catastrophe, but it's usually known in the literature as the Kautzmann paradox. What the specific heat also shows sort of anomalies. This is sort of a sketch. This is a specific heat, constant pressure versus temperature. Here's a liquid. If you, it would drop suddenly, or actually you'd have a delta function if you form a crystal. And in the glass forming case, you have sort of a step that comes down. You can also look at the viscosity, and the viscosity, you can fit it to different forms. One way to fit it would be the Vogel Fulker form. Here's the viscosity as some constant T e to the T minus T naught. And that means that the viscosity diverges, or not diverges, it gets really big as you lower the temperature. So here is log of the viscosity versus 1,000 Kelvin over temperature, and as you go to low temperatures, it's going up. The very popular way to plot it, and this is so popular, it's now known as the Angel plot after Austin Angel. This is log of the viscosity versus Tg over T, and so going to the right is lower temperatures, and you have all different kinds of glasses which fit onto this plot. This is a specific heat here of real materials versus temperature, and you can see there is sort of a step function, or maybe a little peak there that forms. Okay, and then of course you can get stretched exponentials and very long relaxation times and that sort of thing. So let's go back. There's a lot of theory that's been done, and I'm going to, in the interest of time, probably not really talk much about that. But as I said, what happens in the glass transitions, you cool it down, and eventually the time scale for rearrangement exceeds the experimental time, and you fall out of equilibrium. And what does fall out of equilibrium mean? And that's really what I'm going to be talking about for the rest of this talk. A way to describe that is really to be looking at the energy landscape. And so what I want to say is that how can a system fall out of equilibrium? There are actually three ways you can fall out of equilibrium. We always toss that term around rather casually. But one way is that the system can become trapped in a metastable minimum. I cool down, I get stuck up here, and then the temperature's so low the system can never activate its way over this barrier. And so that's kind of the end of that. It just spends the rest of its life in that minimum. The second way you can talk about falling out of equilibrium, and we've heard a number of talks on this, is exhibited by aging. The idea is that your system found itself in the wrong part of phase space. This is really not where it's meant to be. When it does averaging, this, you don't really see Boltzmann distribution. And so what the system does is try to work its way towards the right part of phase space. And this working its way towards the right part of phase space winds up in displaying behavior we know as aging. And so there's a time under which it does this. That's an aging time. It's equivalent to the alpha relaxation time in the glass transition. And it's basically the time it takes for the system to forget its initial configuration. That's the way number two. The third way you can fall out of equilibrium, and in some sense this is obvious, but people don't really appreciate this, is you could have a system that's not stuck in a metastable minimum. It's not aging. It's in the right part of phase space. But it's moving so slowly through phase space that the time it takes to accumulate enough statistically independent measurements is longer than you've waited. And so you haven't done a good sampling job. And that's the other way in which you can fall out of equilibrium. You just didn't wait long enough to get a good statistical sample, and therefore you're not going to get the right values for your equilibrium quantities. What are the consequences of that? Well, what I'm going to show you is that the consequences are, first of all, that you can get a peak in the specific heat versus temperature that solely comes not because you're aging, not because you're stuck, but just because you didn't wait long enough to get good statistically independent numbers enough to get the right value. The second consequence is that you can actually, I think this explains why you see frequency-dependent quantities, such as the frequency-dependent specific heat, in a system which is not aging and which is not stuck. And that's actually been seen experimentally in Sid Nagel's group. No, it's not aging, and I'll show you why I say it's not aging, but you have to... That was basically the short version of the talk, and I'm going to go into why... I'll show you later why it's not aging. Okay? But So hang on to that and wait till the end, and then if you're still not satisfied, we can talk. But I'll show you that. So that's the whole story, and now this is the details. What we've done are molecular dynamics simulations. We have a 50-50 binary mixture in three dimensions of big balls and little balls, two sizes, the ratio of their diameters is 1.4. They have a kinetic energy, and they have a 1 over r to the 12th interaction. It's purely repulsive. It's called soft spheres, and we cut it off at some point so that the first derivative is smooth. We cut it off linearly. And so this is we fix the density, we fix the volume of the box, or not the volume, well, we fix the density and the number of particles, and that fixes the volume. And we have periodic boundary conditions, and we just run this thing with molecular dynamics, which is just integrating Newton's equations. It's just F equals ma. And so one of the things that you typically like to do, what I'm going to do is set a time scale and an energy scale for you in the standard way. And the way it's done in this field is you look at a correlation function, which goes by the name of, I don't know, full intermediate scattering function. But what you do is look at the density, Fourier transform of the density at some time 0 and the Fourier transform at some time t, and you get this function, correlation function f, and you just plot it versus log of the time. And what I've done here is taken a point that a temperature that's slightly below what's called the mode coupling temperature, but it's a low temperature, and basically when this relaxation or correlation has fallen to 1 over e, that's what you call the alpha relaxation time. So here it's a million time steps. So I'm going to...
What is the mode coupling derivative?
That's the next slide. So to find the mode coupling temperature, what you do is you basically look at that same function or a slight modification of it, And according to mode coupling theory, the relaxation times go as a power law, and so do the viscosities. Relaxation time and viscosities kind of go together. And the idea is that the relaxation time would go as T minus TC to some power gamma. And this is a good theory at high temperatures as long as you're above TC. It doesn't work so good once you get close to TC. So this is a high temperature equilibrium theory. And here is the correlation function versus log of the time. And this is all at different temperatures, these different curves. And I've just drawn a line of 1 over E. And then I just look where, what times those things hit to get my relaxation times. And so I get relaxation times versus temperature. I fit it to this curve, and I get a mode coupling of 0.3. Okay. So that sets the temperature and time scales that I'm going to be interested in. I showed you some data, and there's an awful lot of theory that's been done, a lot of interesting ideas. You know, we're all familiar at least with some of them. One of them is energy landscapes. But I can basically take the theories and I can divide them into two categories. And there's the category that says, the camp that says, we believe that the glass transition is a kinetic transition. And what does that mean? What that means is that sort of the idea that the system has broken ergodicity, it's gotten trapped in some metastable minima, and it's just not going anywhere. But the idea is that if you could actually measure true thermodynamic properties, if you didn't worry about getting stuck, you could just really do a true ensemble average, you would not see any discontinuities or non-analyticities in any thermodynamic quantities such as free energy or specific heat or whatever. So that it's purely a kinetic phenomena. The second point of view is that it's a thermodynamic transition. And the thermodynamic idea is that you would calculate some quantity in the standard thermodynamic average way. You could really average all of over all phase space, over all configurations with proper Boltzmann weighting. And if you did that, you would find that thermodynamic quantities would tend to diverge or display some discontinuity at the glass transition temperature. So that's a thermodynamic picture. And so people like Parisi and Mezard have been proponents of this. You can put a whole bunch of mode coupling lies in the kinetic transition camp. Camp saying it's kinetic transition. People who look at dynamic quantities such as Scherer and Glotzer, all that would fall into there. So we had this idea. We said, gee, is there a way when we do our molecular dynamics, could we possibly avoid getting trapped? Can we keep from getting stuck in a well? And so Peter Young suggested that we look at parallel tempering and do parallel tempering. And parallel tempering is a very nice idea, very successfully used in spin glasses. And the idea here is simply that you pick the temperatures you're interested in. And you run your simulation at those temperatures in parallel. So these are four temperatures, and this is versus time, and I'm just running four simulations in parallel. Every once in a while, I ask two neighboring temperatures, would you like to switch your configurations? And I do that with a Boltzmann probability, or in such a way that at any given temperature, I get a Boltzmann sampling. And the benefit of doing this is that suppose you're at a low temperature and you're stuck in one of these low temperature wells, then you can wander around in temperature space and work your way up to high temperatures and basically work your way out of that well and then come back down later and find yourself in a new well. So that was the hope of doing parallel tempering. All right, so what do we see if we actually do parallel tempering? And this is what we see. This is the specific heat versus temperature. The upside down triangles are the specific heat calculated with fluctuations. The magenta line is the derivative, dE dt, the other way to calculate specific heat, and you can see that they lie in perfect agreement. So there's no violation of the fluctuation dissipation theorem, at least as I understand it here.
How many temperatures do
we keep? I think we keep 50. Yeah, we keep 50 temperatures.
Evenly spaced?
No, no. You space the temperatures. You can tell, I mean, you can sort of tell here. You space them so that you have a high acceptance rate. So at some point, they get really close together as you go to lower temperatures. And there's been work on whether it's really worth all the trouble of doing this. And some extent, you get kind of the same answer if you just do the straight cooling. So what we've done is, here's the curve again, but I'm showing you here all different system sizes, 8x8 and 512 particles, 216. We have different run lengths here. I also have here the product of just doing a straight cooling run, and everything falls on top. So that means there's no size dependence, no finite size scaling, no second order phase transition, at least from this evidence here. It's not saying that you couldn't have one further down. And so the question was, this peak in the specific heat, is it a real thermodynamic peak, or is it the result of falling out of equilibrium? And the answer, the short answer is, it's a result of not being in equilibrium and not doing adequate averaging. But are we getting stuck? Are we stuck in some metastable minimum? We can show that we're not. And the idea here is to look at something called inherent structures, which is what Stillinger and Weber came up with this idea, and that's what they named it. The idea is, you have an energy landscape, you have local minima, the configurations at these minima are called inherent structures. And the inherent structure has an energy. So what we do when we run is that we, every once in a while, save a configuration. We go back later, take that configuration, do steepest descents, really conjugate gradients, we quench down, and we find the bottom of the well it's sitting in, and take that energy. And we do that for a lot of configurations at any given temperature, and then we can plot the inherent structure energy versus temperature. And let me do a little bit better plot. Here is a plot of the inherent structure energy versus temperature. And the idea is, here you do, and then you cool down. And the fact, this is where the peak occurs in the specific heat. And the fact that you continue to find deeper basins means that you're not stuck. If you were stuck, what would you see? You'd see this, which is, these triangles are the result of cooling. And that is basically, if you're stuck on the same well in the same basin, every time you look, you would just kind of get the same inherent structure energy. And you cool down, you're still in the same basin, you'd get the same inherent structure energy. So you would just see a straight line if you were actually stuck. So the fact that we're continuing to drop here means we're not stuck, though I will admit that this is an inflection point. So maybe it's starting to roll over very slowly.
Can I just ask for a clarification of what you do when you do this with parallel tempering? Because I thought, in looking at these inherent structures, you let the thing run at a certain temperature, and then you drop down to see what states you found. But the parallel tempering, you're doing many temperatures at once, so I'm...
We save the configurations. We write them to disk as we're doing the parallel tempering, so...
But then you want to use the ones that occurred at a particular temperature. When you follow this as a function of temperature. But
that's right.
Parallel tempering is done with many temperatures.
Right, so I have many temperatures. I don't know. I did this with, say, parallel tempering, and so when I did parallel tempering, I had a bunch of configurations at that temperature that I recorded to disk. And then I went back later, after I finished my run, I quenched them all down, and I found the energies, and I took the average, and I got that point.
But sometimes when you did this parallel tempering, I thought you said that you were running at one temperature, and then you took all the configurations from another temperature.
No, I run them in parallel, so there's just, this guy's tooling along and this temperature's tooling along, and then every once in a while I just switch configurations. I rescale the velocity so they're at their new temperature, and then I just keep going.
But you always have to go for a little bit longer before you use the bits that you get to search for the thing. I mean, you might have been running at one temperature, you then change that configuration to another temperature. You don't want to count it.
But you do, because it's in equilibrium. It's okay, it's in equilibrium, because you rescale velocities, they're very close, and you would only accept them with a Boltzmann weighting. You don't just arbitrarily accept them. There's a Boltzmann probability with which you accept them. So the configurations you sample at any given temperature are a Boltzmann weighted distribution. I mean, that was the whole point.
So what about the fluctuation of inherent structure
energy? What about it? You want to see a picture? I can show you.
Yeah.
All right, I wasn't going to show you these pictures. It's very noisy. Here is a picture of inherent structure energy versus time at a point just below the peak. And it's, like I said, it's noisy. I mean, here's the inherent, but look at the scale. I mean, this is 1.08, 1.1 point, 1.185, and you can see this is on a log scale, and if I plot it on a linear scale, you just kind of get a lot of noise. But it's not decaying. Within the noise, it is not going steadily down or anything. That was the point. So you don't necessarily see aging in that. Okay, so we're not getting stuck. That rules out the first way to fall out of equilibrium. I got two more to go. What we've done here to show that we didn't do sufficient aging and didn't do sufficient averaging is that I pick a point that's just below the peak in the specific heat. And that peak in the specific heat occurred at the mode coupling temperature, I should point out. I pick a point at a temperature just below the peak, and I sit at that temperature and I run. I equilibrate for 50 million time steps, then I start running for another 100 million time steps, and I record every single energy that occurs in that 100 million time step. And we do this over and over again. And so then what I have is a list of 100 million energies. And so what am I going to do with that list? I'm going to break it up into little segments, like 100 segments. Each segment would be have 100 energies in it. I can calculate the specific heat for each one of those segments. So here is the specific heat. So here's my list of 100 million energies. I cut it into little segments. Each of these segments has a million energies. And I calculate the specific heat using fluctuations, so for that little segment. And then I get that point. So this is specific heat versus time. And by time, I mean the time at the center of this segment, say. And I get a point here. And then I calculate specific heat for this segment, and I get the next point, and so forth. And what I get, therefore, for that top one is this squiggly line here. Then I go back and I take the same set of 100 million energies, exact same data, and I cut it into bigger segments. I cut it into segments 2 million time steps long. And I have 50 of those, and I calculate specific heat for each one of these segments. And this is what I get, the middle line. And I can take my 100 million energies, cut it into segments of 4 million apiece. I get 25 of those, and I get this magenta line, same data. Now, you should notice two things from this. First of all, you can see that the average is going up, even though I'm taking the same data. Secondly, you can see that it's not really aging in the sense that these curves are not steadily going down or going up, that it's just wiggling, oscillating about the same average value. So that's one reason why we say it's not aging. Now what I can do is I can take the average of this and I get the specific heat average for that particular time span, for that particular segment size, and so on for all of these. And what I get then is the specific heat versus time span at that temperature. You can see that it's going steadily upwards as I just simply take bigger and bigger segments, all of the same data. This is the marvels of having a nonlinear function.
Excuse me, could you explain that again with the previous concerns? I would have thought that if you average over bigger ones, no, the previous ones. So. Couldn't you have changed the red curve by just averaging the black one?
No, if I average the black one, I get this value.
I'll
tell you that in a minute. We'll get to that. It's basically the fact that the specific heat is the variance. If you only take a small number of samples, you get a narrow variance. If you take more and more samples, you get a bigger variance.
What about the E over VT? I mean, that's a linear function.
That's a linear function.
You showed before that the peak is there also.
Yeah, here I'm doing everything at one temperature. And So I'm not going to be able to do a DEDT if I just do everything at sort of one temperature.
But, what I mean is that in D or DT you shouldn't have the same problem, and the cell animates here are separated at the full temperature.
The point is that for each of these segments, the average moves around. And if I look at, you know, in principle, I could take an average value of the energy. So here is, for example, what I plotted here is the average energy for a million time steps. Each circle is an average energy for a million time steps. You can see the thing all fluctuates around. and this is at one temperature. So to do dE dt, I probably would want to take the average energy, and then if I did that over the same number of time steps, then I you know.
I mean, if your values of E at two different temperatures are uncorrelated, either you should see this as a cheap landing in the specific
heat. They're not uncorrelated. As you go down in temperature, your energies are going down. So it's not that they're uncorrelated.
They are uncorrelated because you are using parallel tempering.
They're not uncorrelated because I'm using parallel tempering. You're sampling different parts of... I mean, this here is not parallel tempering. This is just running at one temperature. I'm not switching anything. I'm just running at one temperature, and that's the end of it. The EDT, as I showed you before, matched perfectly what I was doing for the fluctuations at that time. And I think if I did a longer time scale or a shorter time scale, and I did the same thing, I'd get up to a point, I'd get, again, perfect agreement.
There's a drift here, right?
Where? This one? Up one or... The lower one. The lower one is simply okay. So what's happening here is that the lower one is, if I take this point here and I plot those energies, I get this curve. And if I plot a point up there, I get this curve. Okay. And the point here is that it's the variance that gives you the specific heat. And the variance is about the same for both of these, but you can see the averages have shifted. Okay, and so effectively, should I take the talk out of order? Let me not take the talk out of order, and I'll come back to that, okay? Just so people don't get confused. So what I showed you, this is a plot of the specific heat versus the time span, versus the number of energies I'm calculating the specific heat from on a log scale. And what I showed you was a point at a temperature. These are at three different temperatures. The purple ones are at a higher temperature, and they plateau after a while. If you go to a slightly lower temperature, you see that the specific heat flattens off or equilibrates, plateaus at a slightly higher value. And this one just below the peak seems to keep going, and I would really like that to flatten out. So what I can do is simply do the same trick, but take all of the runs I did, string them all together as one big fat run, do the same thing, and here's the specific heat versus the log of the time span. And you can see that the black one that wasn't flattening off eventually does flatten off down here at about, it's about a billion time steps, 2 billion time steps or something like that. And the thing is that this is the temperature where I said the alpha relaxation time was a million time steps. But I'm actually having to go out quite a ways beyond a million is way down here, way in order to get actually the equilibrium value. So what I can do is I can, these values where it plateaus are the equilibrium values of the specific heat. I can take those values and put it back on my specific heat versus temperature curve. Yeah, Alan.
Why are you stringing together uncorrelated runs?
Yeah, and why would that work? But if you look at it, the solid... the solid lines, okay, the solid lines are actually for individual runs.
Yes.
And the circles are actually when I did the stringing together. And you can see they agree very well in that regime.
Well, they should over the short time scale because the points where they meet its boundaries are small. When you're averaging times are small, you'll get effects when you cross the boundaries from one run
right
to the other. But the effects may be small, you have small averaging times because the number of averages that are affected is just going to be equal to the number of different runs you have.
Yeah, it doesn't, if you look at it, it doesn't really seem to affect it. I mean, the fact that we kind of do get good agreement for these things.
You should, because...
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I do understand what you're saying, actually.
I guess I was thinking that if you're going along here, that you think that the variance varies depending upon time scale. I think there's really different frequent, in one way, the simple linear way of thinking, it would be that there would be many different frequencies. Some are very long, and the long frequencies contribute to the variance, meaning the longer averaging times. And now here, when you're stringing different runs together, you've thrown away any
connection to the correlation.
If you think about it, specific heat shouldn't matter about correlation. Specific heat is simply an ensemble average. You can take a bunch of snapshots of the system, scramble them in any order, and calculate your specific heat. That's what a real thermodynamic specific heat is. It's not a history-dependent quantity. It's a purely a thermodynamic.
But if you string your measurements together in any order, you will destroy this effect and on measurement of the time span.
The point was here that it didn't matter when I showed you, if you will, if I just take... the only thing is that the higher up points get fewer and fewer segments over which they're averaged. But the thing here, the point of this curve, was that it doesn't really, you know, you'll get fluctuations about the average value, but it's not really going to vary that widely. That if you do a lot of this, you're going to get the right value, if you will. The thing is that, go ahead. So all I'm saying is that I can take, you know, a segment here, and I take a segment here, and I look, and it's I get a point here, and I get a point over here, but it doesn't really vary that much.
Yeah.
So that's sort of why I think you can get away.
But if you scrambled the data, took the data,
and scrambled it.
Scrambled it, you would not see that effect anymore.
I don't think it would. I don't think it would affect.
You see a variance. That was your maximum variance at each time span.
I mean, the other way I could do it is just take it and yeah. The question is whether it changes as you get more and more. Let me go through why this happens and then see if that helps. Okay, but I think I understand what you're saying. I don't think it's that big a problem. But let me explain where this comes from and then we'll come back to it. Okay, I do. Yeah, the intermediate, full intermediate scattering function.
At the intermediate or coherent scattering?
What?
I mean, single particle scattering function or collective?
It's the density-density correlation function. You take the Fourier transforms of the density at two different times and look at that. So it's the, it's from the full intermediate scattering function evaluated at the peak and structure factor, technically speaking. So let me go back to what I was talking about, which was that I think that these flattened values are the equilibrium values of the specific heat. And let me go back to my plot with the peak and plot those equilibrium values and see what happened to the peak. So here is the specific heat versus temperature. This is what I showed you before. The new points are these solid triangles that I got from the equilibrated values. And what basically I'm saying is that the peak goes away and this thing continues to go up. And it goes up really fast. And I don't know where it's going. That's sort of the $64,000 question. You know, is there, if there's a true thermodynamic peak, that would be a phase transition. Is it going off to infinity and diverging at zero temperature? I mean, there are not that many directions on a, it can go. So it goes up, it flattens, or it goes down, right? All of which kind of don't make sense. All right, so what's going on here? As I said, this is the idea is the variance is the same whether you're here or whether you're here, and the variance is what gives you really the heat capacity. And so the picture that you come up with is this. This is, say, the number of configurations. This is the potential energy per particle. You get a lot of energy, so you get a distribution of energies. And so down here, you get a distribution that's centered at a low energy. And up here, you get a distribution that's centered at a higher energy. But the width of the distributions are about the same. And it's not unless you take the whole thing that you get something that's more accurate in terms of the correct variance and the correct specific heat. So the idea is that if you wanted to take a, find the mean, suppose I told you to find the variance and the distribution of the average incomes in Los Angeles. And say you didn't have a car and you walked on foot with a clipboard and you walk around in the poor section of town and after a day you get all different incomes, but what you're going to get is basically, say, Gaussian distribution centered at a low average income. After a while, a few weeks, you manage to get to the middle income people and you maybe get this as the distribution. But to get the full distribution and the full variance, it's not that in one day you kind of get a distribution with the same width that may be centered at different places because of different average incomes, But you have to kind of walk all over Los Angeles to get the true distribution, and you're going to get a much wider width. So the idea is that as you, and the width of this distribution is the specific heat. That's the variance over squared over temperature. And so that's why as you go longer and longer, you're going to get a bigger and bigger specific heat. You get a bigger and bigger variance. You're going to see more and more of Los Angeles and a bigger distribution of the incomes. And so if you don't wait long enough, if you don't wait long enough, what you get is the low temperature side. You get a peak because you get values that are really too small because you have too small a variance because you didn't wait long enough. You didn't get a good enough sampling. All right, the final thing, and I think this is quick, is that I wanted to relate this to frequency-dependent specific heats. And frequency-dependent quantities are seen in glassy systems, and these are dielectric constants, real and imaginary parts, versus log of the frequency taken in Sid Nagel's group. And the idea is that here's the real part of the dielectric constant. It moves steadily to lower, as you lower the temperature, it moves steadily to the left and is frequency dependent. And they've taken great care in doing these experiments to make sure that they were not in the aging regime. This is a specific heat, frequency dependent specific heat times actually the thermal conductivity, the real part. And again, here's the curve versus log of the frequency. This is at a higher temperature. As you lower the temperature, you're steadily going inwards. So you have a frequency dependent specific heat. So you can see the curve at high frequencies down here, and as you go to lower frequency, the specific heat is going up. They actually showed that the thermal conductivity doesn't have much frequency dependence.
What is the frequency in the experiment?
Hertz and less.
No, but what kind of, how do you measure the frequency dependent specific heat?
They put in, I think they put in a time-dependent pulse, and then they measure the, I can give you the paper, because they put in a time-dependent pulse, in other words, an oscillating pulse, and then they look at the RC time constant, I think. I'm not actually sure. Do you know?
No, an experimental. They measure the capacitance, the dynamic capacitance, the partial frequency.
This is specific heat, though. Capacitance won't give you that. So this is an experiment that was pioneered with a technique pioneered with Norman Burge, and they did.
In that case, what they usually do is they apply a pulse and they measure the response. I mean, you know, it's an RC.
No, but they apply a sinusoidal.
I think they do a sinusoidal pulse.
No, but
yeah, they
it's a sine wave.
It's okay. So I have to admit, I can give you the paper, but I don't remember exactly the details of how they did that. But it was done with Norman Burge, and they did some work since that. And they've been very careful to not be aging. They're very much in equilibrium. We can calculate the frequency-dependent specific heat, and here I'm just using the approach of Gary Grist and Sid Nagel. You define a correlation function in terms of your energies. Remember, I showed energy as a function of time, and I had all that. So I have the difference in energy at zero and the difference from the average energy at time t, and that gives me a correlation function. And then I just take a Fourier sine transform, and you can sort of show in the limit of zero frequency, this will give you the zero frequency DC specific heat, and this obeys Kramers-Kronig. And I can do that. Here's my frequency-dependent specific heat versus log of the frequency, and these are those three temperatures. And you can see that the specific heat goes up as you lower the frequency, and at these higher temperatures it does plateau off. Now I'd like to relate this to those time span, specific heat versus time span plots that I showed you earlier. And why can I relate that to frequency? The thinking is this. If I lower the frequency, I have a longer period of oscillation. That means I sample more energies. That means I have a bigger variance in my energy distribution. That means I get a larger specific heat. So that's why I'm relating frequency specific heat to this time span thing. And so what I've done is, this is a plot I showed you before, specific heat versus log of the time span. And now I've also put on it the inverse frequency or the period. And those are the solid dots, and you can see it follows the same trend. It lies below here just because of numerical problem. We can't take that correlation function for all values just because it's an n squared. We don't have enough room and time in our computer. So we just take every 350th energy. And because of that, I'm missing some of the low frequency contribution to the specific heat, and I don't get the full value. And that low energy cutoff gives me some oscillations. So that's just a technical artifact. But basically, you see the same trend. Lower frequency, longer period, you get more energies, you get a larger variance and a larger specific heat. And so that's why I think you get a frequency-dependent specific heat.
Why not time-dependent?
A time-dependent specific, yeah, I mean, if you want, you can do that, just the correlation function, and that gives you sort of a time-dependent specific heat. That's one way to define it.
Yeah, it increases with the time.
What?
It's typical of glasses.
It increases with time.
No, it's not that it increases with time. It's not aging. Those systems are not.
It has nothing to do with aging.
It's just that you have, if you average over a longer time.
The longer
yeah.
The
yes, right. That's right.
The more it can take, yeah.
That's right. So let me just real quick answer Christina Marchetti's question. And I say there's not aging. This is not a result of aging because my specific heat versus time span, these were all flat, they weren't aging. That was one piece of evidence. The other piece of evidence is the way that people typically look for aging in these systems is they take it, they quench it, they look at these correlation functions, this intermediate scattering function, and you can wait for different times after you've quenched. So that's a waiting time. And if you look at this, this is the correlation function versus log of the time. If you look immediately after you quench, you get this. And then as you wait longer and longer after you've quenched, before you start taking your measurement, different waiting times, then you start getting these curves. And once you get past a million time steps, you don't see aging anymore. The curves all fall on top of each other within the noise. So you don't see any aging after the 1 million time steps or the alpha relaxation time. So that's why we believe it's not its system that's aging. That's not why we got the peak, the specific heat. So let me just conclude. What we've done in this part was just done a molecular dynamic simulation in three dimensions of a soft sphere binary fluid, and we see a peak in the specific heat because we fell out of equilibrium in the sense that we did not take enough energies to get a proper average. If we take enough energies, go to longer times, then the peak goes away and the specific heat versus temperature just seems to go up. And this, I believe, sort of is mirrored in the frequency-dependent specific heat. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much.
I mean, I do not understand. I mean, can you show us your figure of the specific heat again, please?
Which one?
The last one.
Okay.
I mean, this is something which, as you are saying, the left part of the peak is time dependent. I mean, if you would be able to do a very long, long simulation,
yeah.
Assume that you're able to do 10 to the 10th,
yeah.
Then you would see that all your peak moves to the left, right?
It doesn't move to the left. It's sort of that if you get values, if you have values where you've actually plateaued, you don't get a peak. You just you eliminate this and you just get something that goes straight up.
So my point is that it would be much easier to verify all these time dependent effects. If you, for instance, reduce by a factor of 10 all your thermalization time in your simulation, your parallel tempering simulation, you divide by a factor of 10 all your time scales, and then you should see that your peak moves to the right.
I don't see how I can do that because the time scales are temperature dependent.
You the shorter time. You showed how the variance grew.
Right.
Into longer averaging time.
Yeah.
You plot the shorter averaging time variance to get a vector. You can so yeah, look at shorter periods of your data. You've already got the data there. It should be a piece of the right.
Yeah, the peak would steadily, if you you get these points up, but then, say, for lower temperatures, I couldn't stay in equilibrium, so then the peak would occur lower, at lower temperature. But I don't really see how that, I mean, that just moves my peak around, but what I want to know is what happens at these low temperatures, and I don't see any way to get there.
Well,
I can move the peak around, and but I can't get out of that. Yeah.
Based on your conclusion, how do you define the glass transition
for the
effects?
What?
Based on the conclusion, how do you define glass transition on the
surface? I don't see a glass transition. Not within what I can do, but there might be a glass transition. I mean, if you look at Parisi and Maizard, they say there's a putative, or they say there's actually a real thermodynamic phase transition into a few states at a true glass transition temperature that would be way down here someplace. Well, this is zero, so way down here. Okay, and we can estimate sort of a Kautzmann temperature or whatever by fitting to the Vogel Fulker form. That would be down here at 0.1 or something. But I can't stay in equilibrium that long. I should say Juan de Pablo, who's in Wisconsin, has a Wang Landau way of doing these simulations. And apparently he's been able to go to lower temperatures, and he sees us going up. But I can't get him to send me the data, so I don't really know what he sees. So I can't tell you. Okay. David?
Yeah, I've got a couple of comments and questions. One, it seems to me that there is a relationship between the 2 hours of your talks. I mean, both have repulsive interactions between the particles. So, second, your glass problem, you had no attractive forces, only repulsive ones. So,
well, yeah, but I have a neutral background for the electrons. The electrons have a neutral background. I mean, the system as a whole is neutral. That's
okay,
tacitly
so
put in there.
You have to have some way to confine the system inside the box, which you
yeah.
can do artificially by.
Right, exactly. Exactly,
like
yes.
That. But that you might expect that the second one would have some kind of classical linear transition if there were not the problem of the, you know, the different sizes. But I suspect that there is a.
There is a crystallization, yes. I mean, we've looked at the crystal. We did that as a check, and we see a beautiful. Here is the crystal, single component system. So it's not going to be glassy. It's just one size of ball, and it forms a crystal. And you can look in their Bragg spots, and this is a nice delta function, as near as we can get a delta function from parallel tempering. So it actually works really nicely in that case.
Am I allowed to make a kind of plug for the relation to the first one? Just to mention that Reinhold Opperman and I recently looked at the problem which was a Hubbard model with a kind of S-spin-type spin interaction, but with fermionic spins. And in that problem, we looked at the density of states and were able to calculate the density of states close to the Fermi energy in any RSB and limit of full respiratory breaking. And we find a gap in somewhat reminiscent of the thing that you get for Efrosh-Shlosky. And I'd be interested to discuss it.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you about that.
And if I might also make a comment on the last bit, when you talk about inherent structures, I mean, one tends to think of the inherent structures with respect to problems where you do some kind of, if it was a spin problem, spin fluid dynamics, I realize this is a particle problem and so on, but where you can get to by sort of dropping the energy to zero and just going downhill also depends upon your dynamics, so that if you have a kinetic constraints in your dynamics, as you might have, say, in something like a Cope-Anderson model of spins or something like that, then the inherent states you get to would be different. I don't know whether that's ever thought about.
Here you're basically, I mean, we do what's called conjugate gradients. You just kind of go down, right,
yeah,
with
the it's a continuous problem.
Yeah, it's a continuous problem. And
in the spin problems,
has it been done in
spin flip only, single spin flip, whereas that may not be enough.
Right, no, I think that's true. You can get hung up there and you just find a different local minimum. I don't know if it's been done in spin systems. Do you know if it's been done in spin?
Yeah. Well, there are lots of people looking
for inherent structures. Okay.
Further comments? No, that's fine. We have more time.